You can now listen to Conning the Con ad-free on Apple subscription and buymeacoffee.com/Conning the Con. But that is not all you will find there. I've got two little words for you. Tonka Trilogy. If you know, you know, right? And if you don't, keep listening to Conning the Con and it will all become clear soon enough. And if you want a sneak peek, head over to @ConningTheCon on Instagram and get a look at the lighter side of this, well, very heavy con story. Simply click the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts for ad-free and bonus content. Or if you aren't an Apple user, head to buymeacoffee.com/ConningTheCon, where on top of that ad-free and bonus content, you can access exclusive videos. You'll find all the links, as always, in the show notes. Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal, because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today. Hi, listeners. This is a bonus episode and the final in the series. If you've enjoyed the content, then make sure you've subscribed wherever you listen to your podcasts and have also followed Conning the Con on Instagram and Facebook so you can be the first to hear about the upcoming series. And as ever, if you would like more information on how to deal with stress and trauma, visit Dr. Muir's website at drsophiemuir.com or Emma's website, thebreatheffect.com. There is a wealth of information, tips, tools, courses, and retreats. Literally something for everyone. And finally, thank you for joining us on this journey. Please do help us spread the word whatever way works for you, like leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, sharing on social media, or simply telling a friend. You just never know. Your share might be the one that stops a loved one falling victim to the world's complete oversupply of con artists. Something is creeping in, don't follow it down. Nelson Mandela once said, "No one truly knows a nation until one has been inside its jails. A nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but its lowest ones." But if you've lived on the right side of the law and the closest you get to prison is an episode of Orange is the New Black, then really who stops and thinks about whether the system of justice and hopefully rehabilitation is actually working to protect you and the community as a whole? I know I certainly hadn't spent much time thinking about it until Andrew Tonks came on the scene.
At the heart of the episode is this question: does our system have the resources to send people like Andrew back out into our community rehabilitated, so we are protected from repeat offenders?
I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris, and this is my story, Conning the Con. Shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and her hands hold a mug that's cold. A shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and up to the mountains her gaze is pulled.
This whole story has two sides to it. It has my side as experience of the victim, and there's this piece of the criminal, and not maybe just Andrew, but any criminal, and how they are put into this prison system and how they are or are not rehabbed. And it was something that sat with both both Sarah and I, as part of this process, of wondering what happens to them in there. Are they going to come out better, worse, or just the same? And what influence do we have in that? What is happening in our communities, in our prison systems, that is helping these people turn their life around? And I think big questions was, is that even possible for someone that has conned? And that's why we wanted to sit down with Sophie and ask her from her side and her experience working in the criminal system, what's going right, what's going wrong, and what can we do better?
So we're going to begin this episode at what really is the beginning of the end, for Andrew at least. Because when he's arrested, he spends almost 9 months in remand, which is a kind of limbo land waiting to either come to trial or go to sentencing. And that depends on the plea that the person has made. So I asked Dr. Muir if during that time in remand, are inmates just spinning their wheels, or is there any kind of rehabilitation path available to them from the outset?
Yeah, I've never worked in a remand context, but my understanding of when someone is on remand is basically just a holding time where they're just sort of waiting for their sentencing, and they're not necessarily engaging in any specific offence-focused work or anything like that, because they don't obviously have like a rehabilitative pathway or plan yet, because they haven't been convicted or sentenced. So they can do kind of, I think, some general like life skills programs, I think, might be offered to them, but nothing specific in terms of rehabilitation at that stage. It can be quite a significant period of time. And some people, that time will be counted as part of their sentence, but for others, the sentence will start once they've been actually sentenced. So it varies from person to person.
So what happens when they're sentenced and they move into the general population?
When someone is sentenced, in terms of how they're placed in prison, there's a lot of different prisons, and they're sort of organized according to security class level and then the type of intervention someone might need. So some prisons have special treatment units for violence or sexual violence, or other units will just be, like you say, general populations. There'll be a mix of different offending types. The way that someone will be placed will like often mostly depend on their security class, and that's determined not so much by their level of risk in the community, but their level of risk in prison. So how much of a danger are they in prison? How tightly do they need to be controlled to protect themselves in prison from themselves or from other prisoners? So someone who has like dishonesty offences, who might be more that con man type, they're likely to be placed in a very sort of low or minimum security unit, because unless they have a violent history, they're not going to be a risk in prison. So they'll have quite a lot of freedom. It's often their unit will be quite a large outdoor unit. There'll be kind of like typically you'd see the housing around the outside with a big like courtyard in the middle, and they can be free to kind of roam in and out of their room and into the courtyard and interact with each other. They might have some work inside the unit or kind of out in the bigger prison yards, but these units have quite like a therapeutic feel to them. And they are a lot more relaxed than, say, the maximum security units, where you've got prisoners who will only be allowed to mix or go into yards for a very restricted period each day. They'll have a ratio of 3-1 guards when they're moved anywhere. They'll only be allowed to mix with a very select few others. So it really depends on their level of risk in prison.
How much crime do we have that's at that level? Is it a surprising amount?
What I can tell you is that a lot of the people who are maximum security are very young, like 21 and under. Like it's really scary. And that's actually the population I worked with primarily, was the guys in maximum security, because typically you'd be wanting the people who are quite violent to be going into a group program to treat their violence, because delivery of psychological support is obviously much more efficient if you can do it in a group. But if you're a maximum security class, you can't interact in a group setting safely. So you need one-to-one psych intervention. So the psych team mainly works in that maximum security space with the men one-on-one. Very rarely was a client older than myself. So mostly young guys. And there's a big push at the moment to try and target that group actually help them reduce their security class so they can get access to programs and resources. It's scary, it's sad as well.
Why do you think that age group? Why is that age group so prevalent?
Just you see that with violence, like people who are younger are typically more violent. They have more, like they have less self-control, less self-regulation, so they'll be more impulsive, more reckless. They're also the ones who are susceptible to the gang influences, so they'll have the older gangs, leaders instructing them to perform violent acts. And so they are the ones who tend to get involved in the most incidents in prison, whereas the older someone gets or the more senior they move up in the gang, they might be less involved in that. They don't have to prove themselves so much. But also as people approach the older age group, they do sort of age out of violence in terms of like testosterone levels and those things. You see a decline after the age of about 40.
And now a word from our sponsors.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes, I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Hello, and welcome to Guilty Greenie. I feel like we should start off this show by saying it's nearly impossible to be 100% sustainable given the current world we live in.
How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Not a great analogy for a vegetarian, but, you know.
We're talking about sustainability, maybe not the best analogy.
Don't eat the elephant is the first rule of the Guilty Greenie.
There's your first challenge of the week. Avoid elephants. What they used to call frugal is now considered sustainable.
That's such an aha moment. Frugal to sustainable.
You can save money and help the planet. That's going to be our new
tagline for sure. Yeah,
you can find Guilty Greenie on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And join us in tackling the Guilty Greenie challenges. Until then, stay curiously green.
Okay, so it's Sunday, January
19th.
For nearly a year, my friend Aria dated men she met online. Lots of duds, disappointments, and some disasters. But then along came Mordecai, and Aria fell hard.
I opened the door. There was a woman standing there, and she said, I think you know someone named Mordecai Horowitz? And I said, oh, you better come in.
In 2019, a friend of mine fell for a sensitive millionaire named Mordecai. And then she found out she wasn't the only one. It was way too good to be true. I'm Kathleen Goldhar, the host of Do You Know Mordecai from USG Audio. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
What privileges do they have?
It depends on, obviously, again, security class. But if you are in that lower end, you definitely have a lot more freedom in terms of being able to roam around the unit and kind of potentially have work privileges in or outside of the wire. Typically have certain hours of the day that you'd be allotted like phone calls. It's not unlimited or anything like that. There's often access to TVs. You can lose those privileges if you are involved in like an incident that will be used as a punishment, I suppose. But yeah, typically you would be allowed access to those things.
More specifically then, for people who con, what would it take for a serial conman to actually stop being a serial conman?
So when someone enters prison, they get given a risk score. So their risk of reoffending or being reconvicted. And that score really determines what kind of treatment or rehabilitation they'll be receiving. And their risk level depends on their gender. It depends on how old they were when they first offended, what kind of convictions they have, how many, what is their current offence, how long have they been in the system or in prison, and how long have they had between sentences? Like, have they demonstrated an ability to live in the community safely for extended periods of time? So someone who is a high risk would, or very high risk, would be someone who was very young at their first age of conviction, has a lot of violence offences, has a really high volume of just general offences, has been in the system a long time, and has had very limited time between sentences. So that person would be in the really high risk band. And then someone who has had like a couple of offences of a non-severe nature, who was a bit older at their time of first conviction, and who's been able to live in the community for extended periods of time, that person's going to have a low risk level. So that's kind of the two different ends of the spectrum. Yeah, in terms of rehabilitation, so if you're thinking like people who would get psychological support, those would be the ones who are right up in that top tier risk band. People with violence and sexual violence, they'd be eligible to either go into a group with a psychologist or one-to-one treatment. And if someone falls more in the moderate risk band, they would be eligible to do programs run, like groups run by program facilitators. So not psychologists, but they're sort of focused on similar targets like thoughts, feelings, behaviors, motivation, that sort of thing. If someone falls in the lower risk band, they don't get specific offense-focused treatment. So they might be able to participate in kind of general life skills programs that might be run by different organizations who come in and volunteer or that sort of thing in prison, but they're not going to be doing specific offense-focused rehabilitation.
So more than likely, a con man isn't going to get the psych input that maybe would be needed to help them to stop offending.
Yeah, the only case that someone would be the case that they also have a really high volume of offences, have been in prison a long time, have got, you know, additional violence offences, for example.
That's fascinating from the point of view of like even the judge sort of saying, like, I hope you learn and can train when you get the help you need when you're in jail, and not actually been able to get that when they are there. And if even if you wanted it, is it there, or is it only if you're in that risk bracket because of funding?
Yeah, I mean, psychologists are such a small resource in prison. You know, they can barely get to the people in the very high risk band, let alone people who are lower down in that spectrum. So it is surprising, I think, to a lot of people that there isn't anything specific. The way all prisons work actually is that the intensity of rehabilitative program you're given matches your risk level. So that's across any prison in any country that uses this model. And the research does show that if you give intensive treatment to someone who's low risk it's not necessarily effective, or it can actually increase their risk, particularly if that's in like a group setting where you're exposing them to other people with antisocial values, and you know, they can get ideas if they're sitting there and hearing about others offending. So you don't want to necessarily give intensive group treatment to someone who was a low risk already.
Is there part of the experience of just being in jail that is enough to put you on the straight and narrow?
I wouldn't say that. That was how prisons used to work, on the basis that prison is punishment and people learn from punishment, but that's not how people learn. So that punishment model is long gone. It's not effective. People learn by rewards, not punishment. So no, I wouldn't necessarily say that that would be enough to rehabilitate someone, just the threat of going into prison.
So it sounds like quite depressing. It doesn't sound like it's very effective, and that there's nothing that would actually change people's behaviours through the process. And then they're just released back into the community. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, you know, unless if someone's lack of community support was a reason that they might have offended, then perhaps when they're in prison, they might get access to different organisations that would give them, like, you know, whether that's religious organisations, work skills, that sort of thing. That's not specific offence-focused intervention, but it is building up like a more pro-social life. So access to those kind of community resources might be helpful, or education as well, if that's been a barrier to someone having a pro-social life. So, yeah, while not specific offence-focused treatment, it might reduce their risk by giving them some of these life skills.
When an offender comes out of prison, is there any support there to stop them falling back into old patterns and stop them reoffending again?
So everyone who's released will be on parole. So they will be assigned a probation officer. They will have to report into the probation centre. They'll have certain release requirements, like no drugs and alcohol, appropriate accommodation, that sort of thing. So they will have someone who's checking up to ensure that they are living in accordance with those requirements, but not necessarily intensive support. It really depends, again, on their level of risk as well.
I imagine getting a job once you've got a criminal record, it's very difficult. So how are these people supporting themselves when they go back into the community?
Yeah, a lot of them get income support. I think when someone is released from prison, they get a certain amount of money in that first week. It's not much, though. I remember reading last year there was articles about it that it hadn't been increased in like 10 years or something. So it's not a large amount of money. I think it was, you know, a couple of $100 in the first week, something like that. I don't know if it's been changed now since then, but it's pretty bleak in terms of resourcing. In terms of accommodation, you'd be looking at like shared housing typically, and that's really quite limited. It's actually very hard at the moment for corrections to find appropriate housing for people. It just doesn't really exist. And so then you've got people being put up in motels or other temporary accommodation, and that's really hard. You know, for some people that does put them at increased risk because they don't have like a stable, secure home to work from. You know, it's quite destabilizing, the environment, when they're released.
What is the likelihood of a con man offending again?
Whether someone who cons reoffends is going to depend on their history. You'd be looking at how pervasive their conning has been in the past, like how long have they been able to live without doing that before in the community? So it's really about their history of doing it. It's not so much a blanket rule. Yeah, if they had periods of being pro-social before and working in a normal job and supporting themselves and not exploiting other people, obviously the prognosis would be a lot better than if they've just completely always lived a very parasitic life. It would be quite unsurprising if they didn't reoffend again in that case.
When I listen to what Dr. Muir has said and reflect on what's currently happening in our system, I realise how much of a gap we have. And I'm sure it's not just New Zealand. But it makes me scared for the people that come back out into the community, scared for people that may be their next victims, and that they haven't had the support, the psychological support, to help them build healthy social lives that are actually going to do good in the world. I'm sure there are people that do come out and rehabilitate from jail and do that. But what I've heard is there isn't the system that is helping that at the moment.
I hope you found this bonus episode informative, and if you've had any experience that you'd like to share, then please get in touch. We have links in the show notes. We would love to hear your stories. Shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and her hands hold a mug that's cold. A shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and up to the mountains her gaze is pulled. If you liked our story, please share with family and friends. And like, subscribe, and review so others can learn from my lessons. If you or anyone you know has been affected by something similar, please reach out for help. You are not alone. We've included some links in our show notes. Conning the Con was made with the input of Dr. Sophie Muir, and the original music is by the talented Aroha Min. Something is creeping in, don't follow it down.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing. I'm Sarah Ferris. Join me and my co-host, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program, Catherine Schweit.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've watched the reality of poor planning. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've really sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Our hope is that together we can stop the cries of never again fading into until next time. Hello, my tribe of true crime addicts. It's Sarah from Conning the Con podcast here. And I imagine you and I have quite a bit in common. I am a complete true crime podcast junkie. And having had the opportunity to go to CrimeCon 2021 and meet all my fellow podcasters on Podcast Row, well, I was like a kid in a candy store. Not to mention all of the incredible speakers, exhibitors, authors that were also spilling the tea there all weekend long. So don't miss out on the next CrimeCon. It's in June on the 11th and 12th in London 2022. Trust me, you don't want FOMO. Don't forget to use the code CTHEC at checkout to get your exclusive Conning the Con discount. That's CTHEC. You know, like Conning the Con. I can't wait to meet you all there.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.